MPCA.
Sorry, I hope you all heard that. Anyhow, we're here. Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Ingebrigtsen and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Katrina Kessler, Commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning to testify on Senate File 4061, the DE Amendment. The MPCA also appreciates the inclusion of two of the agency's policy proposals, namely the extension of the St. Louis River Mercury TMDL appropriation and the adjustment to the 3M report frequency. I'd like to spend the remainder of my time highlighting items from the Walz-Flanagan budget for the MPCA that do not appear in the DE amendment. The governor's budget request builds on strong bipartisan agreement last session. It moves Minnesota forward with smart, strategic short-term investments that will secure significant long-term benefits for families, communities, and businesses by increasing our resilience to extreme weather events and reducing pollution that is contaminating water, soils, and air. Mega rain events have become too common in Minnesota, causing washed-out roads, flooded basements, and closed businesses. Minnesota now ranks second in the country for extreme weather events, and according to the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, homeowners insurance rates in the state have spiked 366% since 1998 because of mega rains, high winds, and extreme weather. Earlier this month, I was in St. Cloud talking to Mayor Kleiss, Senator Putman, and Representative Tice about how extreme weather events are harming St. Cloud and Sartell and what resources their communities need to prepare. Preparing communities for extreme weather is nonpartisan. The governor's budget builds on last year's bipartisan work to help communities plan for extreme weather by providing local governments with $55 million to restore stream banks and shorelines, to reduce flood risks, upgrade parks and libraries and other community buildings to withstand extreme weather events, and plant trees to reduce local heat effects. The grant proposal provides resources that communities and landowners are asking for to develop plans that can be leveraged by several programs included in the federal bipartisan infrastructure law. Also missing from the DE amendment is the MPCA proposal to provide waste prevention grants and recycling grants. We are hearing from cities and county leaders across the state that they are experiencing solid waste challenges. Public and private facility operators are interested in expanding recycling and reuse. In the Senate Policy and Finance Committees, we've had bipartisan conversations about the need, the negative impacts of landfilling and the desire to increase funding for recycling and waste prevention. The MPCA's proposal would provide grants to support successful waste prevention programs and for entities to innovatively explore alternatives around food waste, develop recycling markets, as well as exploring composting and anaerobic digestion. These grants would help state and local governments and private entities reduce waste, create jobs, and make progress towards shared climate and sustainability goals. Lastly, missing from the DE amendment are proposals to protect communities from PFAS. These forever chemicals continue to show up in our water and soils. As Senator Eichhorn is well aware, Bemidji continues to address PFAS in its drinking water wells, and last fall, the MPCA announced it for the first time found fish in PFAS in waters in greater Minnesota, including Lake Winona in Alexandria. Also last year, the MPCA announced that PFAS contamination is in groundwater associated with nearly 60 closed landfills in 41 counties. PFAS is not a Twin Cities problem. It's not just a 3M problem. It is a challenge impacting almost every community in the state and our way of life. The governor's budget includes $2 million for grants to help facilities remove and replace PFAS-containing materials from their operations. It also includes a one-time appropriation of $500,000 to better understand current levels of PFAS in soil and water. While other states have taken a heavy-handed regulatory approach to PFAS, Minnesota is using data and collaboration to determine where and how PFAS are entering our environment. Better data leads to better results, and the governor's request accomplishes that. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify and highlight some of the opportunities missing from the DE amendment and share feedback that we are getting from local government partners and businesses around the state. Over the past couple of months, we have testified on a number of other provisions, and we will be following up with a letter with more details in hopes that it will aid in future conversations around the bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And was it mentioned before that you had to leave right away. Otherwise, I'll hold off with the questions, but if you have to leave, we'll...
Mr. Chair, we have members of our team here to help answer, and okay. I apologize All that right. I do personally have to leave to go meet with someone who's been on the schedule for a while.
There you go.
But others can adeptly speak to the questions.
Yeah. Don't let them wait. Thank you so much for your testimony. Commissioner Strowman.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Sarah Strowman. I am the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And I do appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify on the Senate Environment Omnibus Bill. I do want to thank both Chair Ingebrigtsen and Chair Rood for your committee's work this session and assure you that DNR is committed to working with you on this Senate Environment Omnibus Bill. I want to make just a few quick comments on Article 2 and the policy provisions of the bill, and then I'll focus my comments on the budget portion of the bill. I do want to thank Chair Ingebrigtsen for including the DNR lands bill and many of our DNR policy provisions in the bill. These are important elements, and we're glad to see them moving forward in the Environment Omnibus Bill. In addition to these DNR policy proposals, the Senate bill does include some policy provisions on which we have concerns, and we've previously testified to those concerns either this session or previous session. So we, rather than go into detail on them today, we will follow up with a letter to the committee that reiterates our concerns on those. And as I said, I do want to focus my comments today on the budget portion of the bill and specifically talk about some of the missed opportunities that this bill represents. So, Mr. Chair and members, as you know, over the last 2 years, we have talked a lot in this committee and elsewhere about the number of Minnesotans who are embracing outdoor activities in record numbers to manage the stress and anxiety we've all been experiencing the pandemic and to find their solace in nature. So given the value that we're seeing Minnesotans place on our natural resources and outdoor spaces, we firmly believe that now is the time to invest and reinvest in that infrastructure and in those spaces. And I would also mention that because of that extra number of people, that represents a greater wear and tear on our outdoor spaces and a greater level of management for our staff. I was at Nurse Strand Big Woods State Park over this last weekend, and there, because of the number of people that are visiting that park, the staff have had to put up a little rope fence to keep visitors from widening the trail and spreading out and damaging the dwarf trout lilies. And so that's one example in one park of the kind of additional work and wear and tear that is happening as a result of the people being outside. We want them to be outside, but we have to invest to make sure that our resources are sustainable. Mr. Chair, you yesterday pointed out the size of the budget proposed by the governor, and we agree that it is an ambitious budget, but we agree that's rightly so. As we said, it's a reflection of the importance of these investments and the value that they have to Minnesotans. These are one-time investments that will allow us to advance DNR's mission and address critical issues such as tree planting, habitat protection and restoration, improving access to the outdoors, and rehabilitating aging and, in some cases, failing infrastructure. They're also important investments for Minnesota communities whose economic vitality.
And they could be patched in a number of different ways. And so the approaches that you use and the standards help create a quality control help define the quality control of the tanks that would be created and put into the ground. And we think those standards are very important. They're currently not in the bill. So without those standards, you could have a wide variety of different approaches, and some of those approaches could create a threat to groundwater, potentially even to drinking water and surface waters if those contaminated soils and contaminated groundwater were to migrate to those public areas. And so that was the concern that we raised. The other issue with that bill is that these tanks are currently allowed by the state rules. Local units of government can allow these tanks if they agree to their use and if they have a professional engineer that will also sign off on them. So there currently is an approach to use them, but the bill would bypass that local decision-making step. And since, you know, counties and other units of government are responsible for administering the SSTS program, we think that that is an important step, that they should have a voice in that decision-making process. So that was another issue that we raised with the bill. Senator Torres Ray, in terms of your more specific information, I don't know that we have specifics here. I mean, there certainly are areas of the state where our groundwater monitoring data can demonstrate that we have, you know, trends of, you know, rising nitrates and other types of, you know, contaminants in our groundwater. MPCA isn't the only one who does groundwater monitoring. We do it collaboratively with Department of Health for drinking of water and Department of Ag for, you know, agricultural areas of the state. And so the data combined do show that there are areas of the state where there are concerns, and we can provide more specific information if you would like me to gather that and send it to the committee.
Follow up, and then we have to move along to the other testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Vanderbash, do you believe that the legislature could have a process for water fees to resolve some of these issues as it is proposed in this particular amendment that could be fair and neutral and informed as the agencies currently do? This bill proposes that we actually propose fees for water, and I don't feel that I'm prepared to do that. I don't have the understanding that you have or the preparation. I don't work here every day to really have an understanding of how those fees could work or not work. Could you give me your opinion? Do you think that we're prepared to do that?
Go ahead with that. Also keep in mind that the part of the bill is about raising fees, as you know, and coming to the legislature to do that. And I think that might be where she's going with this. So.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for that question. We do have a very robust rulemaking process, and we would use that rulemaking process in raising any of our water fees. Throughout that process, we do we have several steps where we take stakeholder engagement, where we engage with not only our permittees but also members of the public so that we can gather that input and that feedback to any proposed rules. We believe that that rulemaking process is fair, it's robust, and it takes into account a wide variety of perspectives. And so we would endorse that process. At the end of the day, once we go through our rulemaking process, we do have to bring any proposed water fee increases to the legislature. So there is still a step where we come to the legislature and we ask for approval of those raised fees. But that robust stakeholder process, before we make those decisions, we believe is a critical step.
Senator Eaton, real quickly, and then we're going to move on to the other testifiers, and everybody will hang around for questions that they have. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions for the EQB, I'm looking at Section 61 of the delete all, and my concern is, well, could you explain the importance of allowing citizens to petition for environmental review?
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Katie Pratt, Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board. Thank you, Senator Eaton, for the question. Yes, currently, Minnesotans are allowed to petition their government for an environmental assessment worksheet when they have concerns about the potential for significant environmental impact of a project. Currently, anyone who resides or owns property in Minnesota has that right to petition their government. That means if they live in one part of the state, but perhaps they grew up in another part of the state or have ties to that part of the state, they're still allowed to petition their government if they have concerns about the potential for a significant environmental impact. Section 61 of the bill does not change the language around reside or on property, but it limits the jurisdiction, the geographical jurisdiction where you can petition. And so EQB has expressed concerns to this committee before that does limit Minnesota's ability to request environmental review of potential projects.
Thank you. Senator.
Mr. Chair, I won't ask a question. I'll just make a statement.
Go ahead.
The testifiers can respond if they like, but I don't want to step on other people's testimony. Right. So I just wanted to just highlight some of the testimony that we've heard from the agencies, you know, around the lost opportunity that's in this bill. We've heard from, you know, the Bowser, PCA, and DNR about our need to invest and prepare for climate change, resiliency, whether that's holding water on the land, whether that's restoring and rehabilitating our existing park and recreation amenities and facilities, or whether that's addressing the water quality issues that the PCA highlights. You know, there was a very robust proposal put forward by the governor, developed in connection with communities and stakeholders all across the state. And so I appreciated the testimony. I want to highlight those lost opportunities because it'll come back and it'll be more expensive. We either invest now or we have to shell out a lot more in the future, both in private losses as well as public losses. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I see no other questions at this time. We'll move on to the other testifiers. Thank you so much.
Thank
you. If you could just be around for questions if we have. Next, we'll move into the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and the Vice President of the Emerging Development, Kevin Engdahl. If I can get you both to come forward, that'd be great.
Thank you, Chair Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah.
My name is Aaron Clems. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, a nonprofit advocacy group with almost 50 years of experience using law and science to protect Minnesota's environment. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on SF 4062, and thanks for all your work on this bill. MCA does have some concerns about Section 2 of the bill, and we've submitted testimony to this committee and others on many of these, and I won't focus there today, but I am happy to answer any questions you might have about that. Instead, I will focus my testimony on two areas, the White Bear Lake provisions and the Clean Water Act Section 404 assumption appropriation. MCA supports a permanent solution to water quantity issues in the Northeast metropolitan area. We do oppose rollbacks to Minnesota's environmental laws that would allow unsustainable water appropriations to continue damaging White Bear Lake. The water quality and quantity issues for the Northeast Metro will continue until there's a permanent solution, and that's why we're really thankful for your inclusion of significant resources to seek that permanent solution in this bill. In 2014, the district court stayed the White Bear Lake court case for 3 years while the legislature discussed interconnection to surface water or other solutions. Unfortunately, no changes were made in that three-year period. The case then continued, and we find ourselves here today. While the surface water levels in White Bear Lake have rebounded from their lows, the strain on the aquifer, including pollution plumes from several different sources, will continue and deepen over time. The district court found, and MCA agrees, that the collective demand on the aquifer has the effect of draining more water out of White Bear Lake than it can sustain. The result is not one that anyone wants to see, a drying up of the lake or harming the lake's ecology. It's also important to remember that the result of this court case is based on real evidence that the lake is being harmed by overpumping in the area. MCA sees this as an important moment to push toward a permanent solution, not a moment to prop up the unsustainable status quo. And that's why we support Section 69, as well as the appropriation of nearly $500,000 to seek water supply development, citizen engagement, et cetera, and to look for that permanent solution. And that's what we need right now, is putting together a structure to work toward a permanent solution. And I want to thank you for including that in SF 46062. We do oppose some sections that relate to this as well, though, that roll back environmental laws that might allow continued unsustainable water appropriations in the area. And these sections will send a message to future litigants that the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act and other environmental laws should be changed by the legislature in response to a verdict or an order when certain litigants are unhappy with the result. Committee members, this is a critical moment to push forward for the future of water in the Northeast Metro area. Please continue to include Section 69 and other similar provisions to seek that permanent solution. My last comments will look at Section 404 assumption. There's a line, it's lines 3.17 to 4.17, appropriate $740,000 to Clean Water Act Section 404 assumption studies and requires a report to the legislature by December 31st, 2024. And the part that we're concerned about is the part that requires the state of Minnesota to apply for assumption of the Section 404 wetlands permitting program by June 30th, 2025. Our concerns about this have to do with the scope of the program and the scope of federal law in this area, which is in flux right now. Questions about what the waters of the United States are in front of courts and in agencies right now. Depending on the resolution of those, we will have a very different look to what a Section 404 assumption might be. And it only makes sense to wait for those decisions to be made as well as the report to the legislature to be given at the end of 2024 before making a final decision. We just don't feel like you should make that decision 3 years in advance of the report to the legislature. The current estimate for the ongoing state cost to manage this new permitting is approximately $4.7 million per year, but that, of course, will change depending on the scope of the program, and that's in flux right now. And so that's part of another reason why we think there's a good reason for us to wait and making any final decisions on whether to apply for Section 404 permitting. Chair Ingebritz and members of the committee, thanks again for your work on this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Engdahl from the Vice President of the Emerge Community Development, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for hearing my testimony. So I too am testifying on 4062.
Excuse me, for the record, just please identify yourself.
Yeah, my name is Kevin Engdahl, and I am Vice President of Emerge Community Development and its subsidiary, Second Chance Recycling. And I am testifying about Senate 4062. So we are a significant significant recycler of mattresses located in Minneapolis. We process over 70,000 mattresses per year, and we employ over 100 people per year who are returning from incarceration in a transitional job. We do support legislation that would achieve two goals. One, recycling a very high percentage of discarded mattress material, and two, preserving the existing recycling structures that work very well today. As drafted, this legislation does not ensure that either of these two goals will come to fruition, and therefore we oppose the provisions. Some of the concerns that we have, the rate of recycling mattresses could actually be retarded over the long term. And I point to California's program. After 5 years of operation, they only recycle half of the discarded mattresses that come into the system each year. And this is based on their own data. There's lack of standards about the material being recycled. So the absence of these standards could result in the majority of the material still being landfilled. And this is in an environment where 94% of the material in most mattresses is recyclable. That's a level that we, as Second Chance Recycling, already do attain. Other recycling methods may not attain this level. We have skepticism regarding the ability to address greater Minnesota. Population density does matter significantly. The three other states where this program exists are much denser than Minnesota, in some cases significantly, such as Rhode Island, which is 15 times more dense than Minnesota. Convenience standards need to be in legislation, and this is something that the industry has resisted. The results of this could be that residents wanting to recycle their mattress may have to travel long distance to do so. Government units will continue to bear substantial cost. Non-recyclable units are not covered, such as items with bed bug infestation. This has been a discussion point over the last few months, and industry would say that it is addressed, but it is not. The language is very unclear and needs to be addressed. Illegally dumped mattresses is going to continue to be a problem. And this will, the cost of this is going to fall on government units. If you look to some other states, California, for example, 4% of the units are still dumped, and all of those will be borne by counties and cities. Existing recycling systems such as Second Chance that are in place and working well could really be decimated by this program. Recyclers, by their very nature, are very low-margin businesses. We are no exception to that. And we can run at low margins, but we cannot run at no margin. So manufacturers, you know, they do want to take credit for creating the system, but we already have a system that works, and it can be expanded. And I believe that we, as we move forward, we should look to do that as opposed to creating something completely new. I do want to note that there was some legislation passed in Oregon just recently that is has many similarities to what to this legislation. But there are two significant differences between the two. That legislation has convenience standards in it. This one does not. And that is important. Of all the states that have legislation, Oregon is the most similar to Minnesota in terms of its large rural areas. And they laid out this these requirements in the legislation, and industry has opposed doing that in Minnesota's.
Mr. Engdahl, we're going to have to move on. So
okay, two more points. The Oregon legislation also has provisions to cover the cost of illegally dumped mattresses. Minnesota's does not. That will continue to be a problem here. So with that, the last comment I would say is that the cost of this is completely borne on the consumer. The manufacturers have no skin in the game, if you will. They are not paying for this. And I believe the legislation should require manufacturers and consumers alike to equally bear the cost of a program. If we're able to do that, we could support it.
What I would commit to you is to set up a meeting with me. I would like to talk to you about this and look at those other plans. So with that, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
We're going to have to move on here.
May, just a second. I'll appreciate
real,
it.
Real quickly. We have
a couple of minutes.
Excuse me. I'm going to have Marcus Branstad and Marie Clark start heading this direction. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say thank you to Mr. Ingen, who is the Executive Director of Second Chance. Is in my district.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, I would love to invite you and members to come to that organization. They do a fantastic, fantastic job of helping predominantly African-American men, Native American men of color, who need a second chance. I often go there to look for something that I don't need, but I just love to see what you're doing with this population, how well trained they are, how they demonstrate joy in the work that you do with them. And there's so much hope that I feel when I go to the place. So I am quite disappointed that this legislation is not taking us in a direction that we need in order to preserve your program. And I would totally encourage you to meet with the chair, because I know that he's sincere when he's saying that he would like to talk to you. So please follow up and do the work that you need to do with the chair, because I think this is a very important piece of legislation, and you can help us move in the right direction. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you. The other two testifiers, Mr. Branstad and Ms. Clark, are you online? Okay.
Yes.
Ms. Marcus Branstad, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Marcus Branstad. I'm Senior Director of State Affairs for the American Chemistry Council. I'm here to speak in favor of the language relating to the chemical plastic recycling. Chemical plastic recycling encompasses various manufacturing processes that convert used plastics that are destined generally for the landfill into high-quality materials for new plastics. These very innovative technologies can process more types of plastics compared to traditional recycling. Even plastics with food residue that can't be mechanically recycled can be converted into new plastics for use in a virgin, like product for use in food, pharmaceutical, and medical applications. When I say hard to recycle plastics, I'm referring to plastics like polystyrene, expanded polystyrene, films and bags, packaging, food service, and marine and ag plastics. This language will pave the way and give certainty for companies to come to Minnesota, locate there, and be permitted properly. 17 states have passed very similar legislation to this, including neighboring and nearby states, Illinois, Iowa, and Wisconsin. Investment in this particular sector is growing very, very rapidly, especially after China stopped importing plastics from the United States. That is where a lot of our hard to recycle plastics that would be destined for landfills were sent. But since that time and since 2017, 81 projects have been announced in the United States, totaling about $8.7 billion worth of investment that would divert about 13.6 billion pounds of plastics from landfills. And 89% of that money is being focused in the chemical plastics recycling sphere. I know you're busy today, I wanted to keep that. I'll be around for questions later, but truly appreciate the time to speak to you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much. And next we'll move on to Maria Clark. And thank you for hanging around for questions. Ms. Clark?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marie Clark, and I serve as Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs for the International Sleep Products Association, or ISPA. I'm here today to support SF4062, specifically Article 2, Section 53. ISPA represents mattress manufacturers, as well as those that provide components and services to mattress companies. ISPA supports product stewardship's efforts, and our industry has taken steps proactively to improve the long-term environmental sustainability of the mattress industry's operations and products. This includes creating a nonprofit 501c3 called the Mattress Recycling Council, or MRC, which has operated successful mattress recycling programs in California, Connecticut, and Rhode Island for the past 6 years. Through this model, we recycle over 1.5 million mattresses a year and over 10 million mattresses total in our 6 years of operations. We designed MRC so that its activities can be expanded easily to additional states that enact legislation consistent with the existing programs. And just this month, Oregon passed a similar law to bring a statewide solution for mattress recycling. We look forward to working with Minnesota as it tackles the issues of mattress recycling, and we appreciate the dialogue we've had with many stakeholders. We're prepared to continue to work with Senator Howe and interested stakeholders to bring a statewide mattress recycling program to Minnesota. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have about this model or how we foresee it working in Minnesota.
Thank you very much. Members, that concludes the testimony from both the agencies as well as interested parties. So now what we will do is we will move forward with the delete all. However, before doing that, there are some issues that I think some points that were corrected, and I'll direct that to the question to Mr. Stanley on the delete all, the A6 delete all.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think you should adopt the delete all.
Okay. Getting advice from them that I should adopt the A6 delete all. So, members, I move the A6 delete all to Senate file 4062.
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, this is an author's amendment.
This is an author's amendment.
We're putting on by courtesy.
I'm sorry.
Which we traditionally put on as a courtesy to the chief author.
Thank you.
So my aye vote isn't an indication of my support for the delete all.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you. Thank you for pointing that out, Senator Dimmel. Mr. Stanley.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. There is an A11 technical amendment that should be posted and that copies have been distributed. This amendment changes 3 dates that were incorrect in the original bill, and it also adds the repealer language related to the antler point restriction that was left off the bill yesterday. You'll see that it looks like the entire repealer is new, but this is just the way that, from a technical standpoint, we state out a change to the repealer. The only thing that's new here that wasn't in the amendment already is the language on lines 11 and 12.
Members, any questions on the A11? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. All the same sign. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Stanley. Oh, I'm sorry, Chair. I thought you had another one. Members will open it up for, maybe before doing that, I think I'd be remiss in not allowing the chair of the Environment Policy Committee some comments. She certainly has done a lot of work on this bill. And it's right. I just love to put people on the spot, but I'm sure she can give just a couple of lighter comments, if you can, about your process and moving forward, and because you've done a lot of work on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have done a lot of work on the policy provisions. We've had some very good hearings throughout the session, and I'm really excited that a lot of those provisions that we sent forward to your committee have been included in the bill. Sometimes it's just a small change that we need to make, but they're always very important to do that. So I appreciate those changes to the bill. It's sometimes difficult in the policy committee to deal with hunting and fishing regulations when not very many members do that anymore. And so it's really a healthy process that we go through to talk about those issues. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your work as well as on the lands bill that you do every year and moving things forward. So members, I'll open it up for more amendments. Senator Lang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A-10 amendment.
The A-10. Senator Lang offers the A-10 amendment. Senator Lang, to your amendment.
Mr. Chair, this was brought to me by the Association of Minnesota Counties in reference to the public waters inventory. This is... does a few things. The amendment provides that a mandatory environmental assessment worksheet for a project that is not on the PWI would be non-mandatory or discretionary. It also provides that a discretionary environmental assessment worksheet is not required for a project that affects waters, again, that are not on the PWI. This kind of clarifies some of the issues that we ran into last year when we addressed the public waters inventory. It also prohibits petition-initiated EAW for projects, again, that are not on the PWI. So with that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Mr. Stanley, maybe a little further description of the amendment. I think it was quite clear what he was talking about, but if you would like to put your final expert touches on that, we'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, I have nothing to add. I think Senator Lang explained the amendment well. If there are questions, I can try to answer those for you. Okay.
Senator Lang offers the A-10. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
First, I'd like to ask a roll call before I forget to do that.
Roll call requested.
I think we had some discussion of this subject last year.
Yes.
And some substantial concern from the PCA or others who are expert. If PCA or someone could come to the table to help us and the public understand the implications of this proposal before we vote on it. If I recall correctly, there was concern that the limiting language to only in those instances, to only examine the environmental implications only in those instances where it's likely to have catastrophic environmental effects. Additionally, concern that those who might have concern, this is simply permitting more pollution to go into our surface waters without any sort of with a permit that they get free and clear without any sort of analysis of the environmental effects, and no one can petition to have that analyzed more closely. So if the PCA could help us, or the DNR, help us understand better what exactly is being proposed and what the implications are, I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I see Mr. Myers here with his options of going to either the department, I understand. So.
Mr. Chairman, members.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. And thank you, Senator Dibble. I think you outlined some of the problems with this language very clearly. This is the first time we've seen this language. We have talked about the issue of public water inventories, and actually there's a case in front of the Supreme Court right now that's dealing with that issue in Renville County. the impact of this would really remove any ability to look at those projects that are greater than 1 acre or more on any water, unless it's affected in it or catastrophic environmental effects. These systems have impacts upstream and downstream. I'm afraid that if this language would go forward and this work wouldn't take place, we'd be impacting landowners and drainage systems and these impacts, what they could occur, without having a complete review of the hydrological analysis of those systems. It's for those reasons that we oppose this language right now. We've opposed these types of things in the past. We're more than willing to work with the association on concerns they have, try to find a better path forward, but I think this has large impacts that I can't even identify some of them at this time, but we'll provide more information to the committee should this amendment go on.
Can you describe to me how it's going to impact upstream? I don't understand that.
Mr. Chairman, these projects are designed, if it's a drainage project, to deal with all benefited or all landowners on the system. If there's a process that would perhaps widen a coarse current, it could drain people's property that they don't want to see drained. We've seen some of that in some local lakes this year, lakes throughout the state that have been drained because of droughts, because of coarse currents and things being taken out and impacts because of that. It could also impact landowners downstream by pushing more water than what's appropriate for that to come through the system onto their property. So could drain people upstream, flood people downstream. All of those impacts would be dealt with through the environmental analysis or environmental assessment worksheet process.
Okay. I understand the upstream now. I didn't before, but now I certainly understand that if they're going to be included in. Is there some other testimony? And then we're going to move on.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I just want to add on to this.
I'm sorry, you have to re-identify yourself.
Thank you for the
That's
reminder.
That's a rule we have.
Thank you for the reminder. I'm thank Katie you. Pratt, Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board, and I just wanted to jump in and add on to what Mr. Meyer is saying here. Like him, I'm also seeing this language for the first time. I do have a couple of concerns with it at first glance, and you know, be happy to continue thinking about this language with the committee. One is it does appear to limit the ability for local governments to have discretion about how they evaluate potential significant environmental effects on non-public waters. So we do have some concerns about that. Another concern that just jumped out at me is it says here catastrophic environmental effects. It's not clear to me what that might mean and how we would define that. And we know from environmental review that we would want some additional clarity about how that is defined. But happy to continue conversation with the committee. Thank you very much.
Okay, members, any further discussions? Senator Rubin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm gonna vote to put this on the bill today, but this is the first time I've seen this language too, just right now. And so I would really appreciate a meeting with Senator Lange and the stakeholders going forward so I can have this better explained to me.
Very good. As you all know, this is not the last stop. So, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for Senator Lange. Senator, do you know if we have a catastrophic environmental effect definition in policy in the state of Minnesota?
Senator Lange.
Can you repeat that? Sorry. Do we have a catastrophic environmental event what?
Definition in our policy?
Senator Lange.
We do not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A
follow-up.
So how do we go about understanding what this does? We don't have a definition. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Senator Lange.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Torres-Ray, I believe, again, this is kind of last minute. I would admit to that. This was an attempt to clarify what we were doing last year. I would commit to you that I would figure that out and have that meeting possibly with you and Senator Rood, and we can put some defining language in this, if that is a good enough answer for now.
So this has been around since last year, Senator Lange?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This, from my understanding, this was in a way of clarifying the language that we had last year that was fairly vague. That's what this amendment is intended to clean up some of the language.
We're going to go to staff one more time, and then we'll move on. Mr. Stanley.
Mr. Chair, members, just to be clear, the current standard for a discretionary EAW is that it would have possibly a significant environmental effect, I believe. And unless I'm just forgetting, I don't think that is defined in rules either. And so I think what you're talking about is a comparison between two terms, one in the existing rule, one in this amendment, neither of which are defined in the rule, as far as I know. And this would make this similar to any number of cases where we use words that aren't defined in the statute. In that case, under Chapter 645, there are statutory construction principles that would just dictate that the ordinary meaning of those words would prevail. And so, given that, it would be the executive branch agency that would apply this rule that would have to determine what the meaning of those words would be.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have no trouble discerning the difference between significant and catastrophic. And I think that catastrophic is way too high of a bar to place on whether something needs to be evaluated. So I would oppose this amendment.
Thank you, members. I think it's pretty clear that this is going to have a little work, and we have people that are committed to doing that. So, in order to keep it moving, I think what we'll do is I would ask the members vote in favor of it, and we'll continue to work with it as it moves through the process. So, clerk, please take the roll.
Chair Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rood?
Yes.
Senator Torres Ray?
No.
Senator Dibble?
No.
Senator Eaton?
No.
Senator Eichhorn?
Aye.
Senator Lang?
Aye.
Senator Tomasoni?
Tomasoni votes yes.
On a vote of 5 aye and 3 no, the amendment is adopted. Members, any further amendments? Senator Dibble.
I don't have an amendment, so I can hold.
Okay, let's try and get through those if we can. Members, any other amendments? You're really making this awful easy on me today. All right, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could get the PCA's attention again, and maybe the DNR. It might turn out to be the DNR. But continuing on this theme of water quality and permitting, I did want to understand a little better. Again, this is a discussion we had last year, but it's a new year.
So if there
refresh our memories. I'm curious about Section 72 and 78. Which has to do with this whole effluent toxicity permitting, repeals rules and replaces the rule on that with new language. And I think it's related actually to the discussion we just had about
Senator,
about,
would you
emitting pollutants into surface waters. And my question is, just to gain a little bit better understanding of the implications of this rule, particularly as relates to, now I just lost my section, I should have highlighted it. Well, there's some language about no backsliding rules don't apply, and there's some language about, I'll find it in 1 second. The toxicity level as relates to organisms, the sensitivity of organisms, and there's one other particular thing. I'll hold and just ask the PCA to help us understand what the implications are for this repeal of their existing rules and permitting and replacing with this language, which I also understand has some implications for
our delegation of authority under the Clean Water Act. Thank you.
Thank you. Please identify yourself and go ahead and try and answer those questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members, and Senator Dibble. Our understanding, just for the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. MPCA's understanding of this language is that it would mandate rulemaking's outcome, thus preventing MPCA from effectively considering public input. To Senator Dibble's point regarding the Clean Water Act, in direct contradiction of the Clean Water Act, this allows for more pollution, increasing uncertainty to permittees and jeopardizing MPCA's federally delegated permitting authority. Beyond that, just for some context, currently over 40 facilities have permit conditions based on these provisions. If they all wanted to increase their discharge, that would be approximately a threefold increase in toxicity to the receiving waters. Allowing these mixing zones would very likely create conditions that may be toxic to fish and aquatic life. We're happy to follow up with more information for the committee if there are further questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think he has further questions. Senator Dibble, did you have another one? Or?
Thank you. I think he did answer the question. I was curious what establishing whole effluent toxicity mixing zones and whole effluent toxicity water quality based effluent limitations meant. Sounds like we're just putting more pollution in and hoping it gets diluted enough, and that may well not happen. And so that would be my concern about this provision. Mr. Chair, if I could jump on to related question in immediately subsequent, or just a couple sections later.
Senator Dibble, go ahead.
Section 76, titled State Implementation Plan Revisions, that has to do with air quality permitting. Now, we also have obligations under the Clean Air Act, and it seems like there's an indication that this would also call into question our ability to act under federal authority administering Clean Air Act requirements.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself, and if you could answer the senator's question, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Doug Wettstein. I'm currently the Industrial Division Director at the MPCA. The section referring to the state implementation plan, the MPCA does oppose this. Summary point being that it would require us to ask EPA to violate the Clean Air Act in approving Minnesota's state implementation plan, because it would be approving language that does not allow the PCA to show that permittees are in compliance with federal air quality standards. I could go on and give a bunch of examples, but I'll see where you want to go with line of questioning.
Senator Timmel, if I could follow up, could you talk more about the Clean Air Act and how it would violate it?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we currently use our discretion to determine whether a facility must model at the time of initial permit issuance when an existing permit is amended and modified, which may involve construction, or when an expired operating permit is reissued. This section takes away the MPCA's ability to require air dispersion modeling at reissuance of the permit solely. It authorizes operations to continue at an existing facility with unmodified emission levels. If we can no longer require modeling at permit reissuance, then it is more likely that facilities will have to model before a permit for construction or modification is issued. This is typically a less convenient time to model because permits requiring construction tend to be the greatest priority and most time sensitive for regulated parties. This appears to be an unintended consequence, shifting additional time for modeling from reissuance to construction permits. Even if a reissued permit does not involve any changes in emission levels, there could still be issues with national air, ambient air quality standard compliance. There are facilities that have not yet modeled all or any pollutants that have model long enough ago that the results are no longer representative or reliable. The facility may have made or may be making changes that have an adverse impact on dispersion or ground level concentrations, which have not been modeled. Example would be lower stacks, building changes, change in property boundaries, and changes in pollution control equipment. The US EPA may lower a national ambient air quality standard such that a facility that was in compliance no longer is, even though facility emissions have not changed. Reissuance permits typically incorporate all the permit amendments, including ones authorizing construction and modification, that have been submitted since the operating permit was last issued. Since these types of reissuances do not solely authorize operations to continue, this bill does not seem to affect our ability to require modeling for these types of reissuances. This is critical because EPA would be unlikely to approve a state implementation plan amendment that adversely affects our ability to require modeling with construction permits. It's a lot of information there.
So the state of Minnesota would still have to, you would still have the opportunity to apply with the federal for this permit.
Our state implementation plan is basically an agreement with US EPA on how we will run our program such that they then give us delegation to operate within the state of Minnesota, with them sort of looking over our shoulder.
Thank you. Senator Dibble, follow up.
Thank you. That you helped me round out the thoroughness of the discussion, so I appreciate that. I do have another kind of on this theme of permitting and, you know, some of these provisions, which in my from my perspective, I think from an objective perspective, simply allows more pollution, kind of a theme that's woven throughout this bill. Could we help, can you help us and help the public understand a little bit better the implications of Section 44, which allows industrial facilities to not have to update make any capital, if they've made a recent capital investment in pollution mitigation facilities, they don't have to do anything, make any changes for 16 years. Now, I probably have a slightly different perspective than the PCA, who supported this in the public sector. I did not. That's well known. But I'm especially concerned about extending this to industrial, private, for-profit polluting facilities, because I think that means then, you know, as things change, as technology improves, as knowledge about toxins and pollutants is gained, the public has no ability to protect itself from those implications. So, Mr. Chair, if the PCA could help us understand the implications of Section 44 just a little bit.
Go ahead and answer that. However, you know, I take a little offense to the idea that this committee is in favor of polluting the state of Minnesota in any form or fashion, but Senator Dibble has a right to they make those comments. But if you could answer his question directly, please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Section 44, effluent limitation compliance, otherwise known as regulatory certainty, was enacted in 2016 for municipal wastewater permits to provide more flexibility for incorporating changes at those facilities. Industrial facilities were never intended to come under this program. This is because the regulatory certainty for municipal wastewater investments protects public investments in wastewater. Industrial facilities do not use public money, so there is no public interest in protecting that private investment.
So, thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else would like to testify with regards to that? I'd like to hear from the chamber with regards to the last question. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll bite. My name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And just to go back real quick, Same theme, Mr. Chairman. In regards to the state implementation plans for the National Ambient Air Quality Standards that Senator Dibble just touched on, if you look at the language, it just asks the PCA to ask the EPA to amend the state implementation program. It doesn't grant anything. It's still there for any new facility. It's there for any major amendment. This would be for a simple reissuance of a permit. That's all it would do, and we are the only state that does it. And it hurts us in terms of other economic development projects that are proposed for this state. But it would simply ask the EPA to PCA to ask the EPA to update our SIP program. Mr. Chairman, also under the regulatory certainty for wastewater treatment facilities and including industrial facilities, I would miss if I had a year that Senator Dibble and I didn't have this debate. I've been around long enough in 2016 when Senator Weber was the one who proposed this. And it's not unprecedented, but again, to just go back to the language, Mr. Chairman, it says if you look at it, and I don't have the actual section in front of me, but I think it's off the top of my head. I think the language says, to the extent allowable under federal law. So if the feds prevent it, then the state wouldn't allow to be able to do this. And then also for any of these wastewater treatment facilities, the permit is not just granted. There's still a public hearing. There is a public comment period. If the 100 signatures, there could be a contested case and ultimately decided by the Pollution Control Agency commissioner. So there are some checks and balances, if you will, Senator. It's just they just don't apply for it and get a 16-year permit, and only after it's allowable under federal law.
Senator Dibble.
So, Mr. Chair, we can just hope that the feds say no.
Well, Senator Dibble, you and I certainly have talked about this, and it's been a three-way conversation going on for some time. I think it's pretty fair to say, and I just wanted to get the other side, the other side of the equation on the record. So, members, any further discussion or any further amendments? Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need to bring up my concerns about the testimony by the American Chemical Council. I'm, from what I read, from it would be the sections 49, 50, 51, 52, 54, but I don't think this bill is needed to accomplish what they want to achieve. They don't really want a solid waste permit, and they're using already sorted recyclable materials. Instead, the bill would label anything that goes through that plant as recycling, even if it's not. And in Minnesota, you have to turn it into a reusable product. It can't be used as fuel. So they're talking about burning plastics and then not calling it incineration, even if they incinerate it for energy. So I have a real problem with this proposal, and can see all kinds of red flags that it could cause some serious pollution, especially air.
Senator, I think you're referring to some of the handouts I think that we have. Is that what you're asking about? But I know you pointed at the portions of the bill, but are you? I guess maybe I should have mentioned that we do have information in our packets, and I thought maybe that's where you're asking your question from, but that's fine. Thank you.
No, I was.
No, I appreciate your comments. No, I thought it was off of one of them. So, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for you, actually, on section 20, that's page 23. And it's related to the changes in residence license. And on number four, you propose a change for tribal identification card. And I was reading that and trying to understand what that is. And I would like to understand better what that is, if you could speak to that provision. But I am interested in understanding this issue on one, which is at the top of the page of 24, that it says it must contain the enrolled tribal member's residence address. And I know that this is an issue for tribal members that sometimes have an address, but their affiliation is with a different tribe. So there's an issue around residency, and I would like to understand better this entire provision. I don't know if we work with any of the tribal members, or is there anybody here who has been tracking this language and could verify my concerns about establishing new policy for residential address.
Senator Torres Ray, thank you for that. Excuse me, I just about demoted you, Deputy Commissioner Meyer. This was brought forward as a DNR initiative.
Mr. Chairman, members, again, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. And Senator Torres Ray, the language you're referring to did come from our policy and technical bill. It's actually clarifying language to allow tribal identification cards to be used to purchase Minnesota hunting and fishing licenses. So many tribal members have rights to hunt and gather in the ceded territories under their tribal provisions. And we've been working with several bands who want to be able to use a tribal identification card, which is theirs. I mean, it's rightfully so. It's a legal identification. Rather than to now requirements in statute require a state driver's license or state ID card to purchase a hunting or fishing license. So this is expanding those rights, those opportunities to tribal identification. And the requirements here are needed so that we can prove residency to issue them a resident hunting or fishing license. We've been working with the tribal staff that we have been working with on this issue, on this language. We haven't heard any concerns. It's really to clarify that, to make sure that, but a person can only have one resident hunting. You can't be a resident of Minnesota, get a resident hunting and fishing license, and then get a Wisconsin resident fishing license, for example. So we're trying to make sure that that is in compliance, and then work with their requirements and to prove that with the tribal identification cards.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get a little roadmap here. Are we trying to wrap in about 10 minutes?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll ask, as long as the DNR is up here, I was going to call him up and ask him some questions about continuing on my water theme here. And then, Mr. Chair, I'm going to want to make a motion. Mr. Meyer, there's a series of provisions having to do with, I think, starting in Section 31, public waters inventory. I think that gives local units some ability to object to the designation of a body of water as part of the public waters inventory. 32, draining public waters prohibited without replacement. And then the calcareous fens issue is back with us again, which I love so much. A question. Is 4 million gallons per year of water to facilitate the growth of trees? Sounds like a great idea. Want to know if that's a great idea or a terrible idea. But if Mr. Meyer could help us understand, because this comes up a lot, this language, if the public is just reading it, seems kind of opaque and technical and, you know, maybe upon first reading isn't concerning. But what does it mean when a public water is a part of the public waters inventory? What are the implications of that? And what is, you know, I think there's some contention about whether or not our public waters inventory is actually reliable and complete or not. And then, you know, as we go to, draining public waters, you know, and this probably has to do with groundwater too, as well as water appropriation permits that potentially dry out calcareous fens and the like. Can you just help us understand, for the public's purposes, some of these water use issues in those few sections?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, thank you for that. And many of these sections came from other bills that have been heard that the DNR has testified against. So we do have concerns about these, and we'll be submitting those to the committee in great detail in the coming days. Section 31 is from language that we've seen previously, I believe, dealing with, again, the public water inventory work that was done and what we have done through. You may recall several years ago when under Governor Dayton, we initiated the buffer bill, I'll call it, that mandated certain size buffers on these courses of water. The big thing about being in a public water is the size of the buffer you have to put on those pieces of property, which would be 50 feet. Which, if it's not a public water, it is the distance of that buffer is shorter. So those are some of the concerns under that section. Section 32, I believe, comes from the Senator Housley's White Bear Lake bill, I'll call it. You'll see language on 31.5, specifically citing the municipality wholly or partially located within a 5-mile radius of White Bear Lake, which is what the judge's order applies to there. We have concerns about that. Section 33 is language we've previously seen as well that deals with calcareous fens, and if we deny an appropriation permit, oftentimes these are irrigation permits, and then it provides, you'll see, a process for an applicant to file a written request for review of our data and go forward. I believe there's money in the bill to cover those costs as well. We do have concerns about that section. Section 34, we just were made aware of when the DE was posted. The Mount Simon Hinckley Aquifer it's one of our most important aquifers within the state. We had clarifying language previously that dealt with the water train issue and making sure that we had the ability to deny permits to transfer water out of state. It also extended a prohibition on water appropriations in the Mount Simon Hinckley. That was just to the 7-county metropolitan area, to the entire aquifer. So this is to get around that. My initial concern would be if we start with one 4 million gallon project, how many more would we see come in specifically regulated or statutorily authorized for permit? That will always add up. The transferring of permit language is language we've seen again and commented on as, again, Section 36. I could go on and on. There's a lot of different sections in here that we've talked about either through this session through committee or last session through committee. And our letter will go section by section on some of those major policy concerns that we have.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble, I hope that I tried to answer all of your questions.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Yes, I was just, more asking on behalf of the public so they have some gist of some of these water issues that are contained in the ASICs to lead everything. So, Mr. Chair, I would like to make a motion, if I could. I would like to move, and maybe council can help me, I would like to move that we reconsider the adoption of the ASICs. My goal is, in so doing, then that puts the governor's bill in front of us and gives us an opportunity to vote on the governor's bill with a roll call, so I have the opportunity to affirmatively vote for what I think is a package of good policy ideas as well as good investments that we've talked a lot about, so I won't expand much on that other than to say, we've heard about some of the lost opportunities that the commissioners expressed in their testimony around preparing for climate change, et cetera. So I'd like to move reconsideration of the adoption of the A6 and request a roll call.
Mr. Stanley, to that motion.
Mr. Chair, so the committee has adopted the A6 and a couple of amendments to the A6. So Senator Dibble has moved to reconsider the vote to adopt the A6 as amended. Yes. A vote of yes would mean that if the yes votes prevail, then it would be as though the adoption of the A6 and subsequent amendments to the A6 had not happened, and the text of the bill would revert to the version that came to the committee, which is the text of the bill as introduced.
That's the intentions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Roll call has been requested. Seeing no further discussion, call the roll.
Chair Ingerson?
No.
Vice Chair Rood?
No.
Senator Torres Wright?
Yes.
Senator Dibble?
Yes.
Senator Eaton?
Yes.
Senator Hycorn?
No.
Senator Lang?
No.
Senator Tomasoni?
Tomasoni votes no.
On a vote of three, three yes, this number is not, five no, the amendment, the motion fails. Any further amendments? Senator Root.
Mr. Chair, I don't have an amendment, and I know that the time is running short. And I just want to say I really appreciate that in this bill there's the lands bill and the DNR policy bill, some good water provisions, hunting, fishing, ATVs, snowmobiles, and the school trust. And so there's a lot to like about this bill. But I don't think it would be a surprise to anyone that I really object to Article 1, Section 4, and Article 2, Section 66, using the lottery and lieu money for the sports eventing. And so I just want to go on record, and I really think that's a very poor provision, and I hope down the road we have some further conversations. But otherwise, I think it's, you know, we've put together a really good bill.
Points very well taken. Senator Torres-Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I disagree with Senator Root. I think we miss an opportunity to move forward some very important environmental policy. And I'm going to read a few of the proposals that came before us that we didn't act on. There was a request for private forest management for $5.5 million. There was a proposal for grasslands and wetlands enhancement and restoration for $10 million. There was a proposal to fix our parks and do native plant restoration in parks around Minnesota for $1 million. There was a proposal to stream restoration and culvert replacement for $13 million. There was a proposal for land acquisition for $24 million. There was a proposal for fish hatcheries for $10 million. There was a proposal to fix our parks, roads, and trails for $8 million. There was a proposal for public water access for $10 million. There was a proposal for community water conservation for $3 million. All of these items are one-time money that time and time again local communities have come to ask for. In fact, this is just a small proportion of what communities around the state have asked us for. The administration came and proposed that we act on it because we have more than $9 billion right now to act on this. None of this was put in this bill. It is a shame. I am ashamed to be part of a body that doesn't take this responsibility seriously. You had an opportunity to do it. The majority had ample opportunity to ask for a better target and resolve many problems that we have with our infrastructure today. You missed that opportunity. Mr. Chair, it is very unfortunate that you didn't move this committee to have hearings on these issues, to understand the impact on the different regions, including your district. So I am incredibly disappointed with the work of this committee, and I hope Minnesotans let the members know about the missed opportunity and really the need that exists in your own community that we could have resolved in this very day and get it done.
Thank you. And members, thank you for the comments, as well as the good discussion throughout not only this meeting, but all the committees that we had before us. I think we've given the environment and natural resources another good opportunity here to be discussed moving forward with the small target that I have. The bill before you, I think, is as complete as it can be with that target. And with that, and as well as good policies with that, members, I move that Senate File 4062 as amended to be passed and referred to the Senate Finance Committee.
Mr. Chair, may I request a roll call?
You can request. Granted. No further discussion? Please take the roll.
Chair Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rood?
Yes.
Senator Torres Ray?
No.
Senator Dibble?
No.
Senator Eaton?
No.
Senator Eichhorn?
Yes.
Senator Lang?
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni?
Tomasoni votes yes.
On a vote of 5 yea and 3 no, the amendment passes. The bill as amended passes and referred to Senate Finance Committee. Members, thank you very much. We got it done within time. And I believe that's it for the committee. There might be an informational committee coming forward. I would like to talk about disposal of possible recycling of windmills and solar panels and things like that. I'd like to open up that discussion, but that's for a later time, so just stay tuned. So with that, members, we stand adjourned.